in church. It's a revelation for some people. It's all right. It took me a while to get it. I wasn't necessarily raised in that kind of a church, but soon discovered that God's a God that created all of our emotions. We find in God some anger. We find in Him love. We find all these things in God, these emotions. If you really invest yourself in the Scriptures, you find out that He's far more complex than just a cloud or a mist or some obscure force that's out there and unable to be accessed. And we thank God for Jesus who came and showed us that God wanted to reestablish a relationship with us so that we could really truly know Him and be known by Him. And we're a church that believes that when you tap into the fullness of what God has for you, you are going to find that there's more for your life than what you grew up thinking. Some people were asked as a kindergartner, what are you going to do when you grow up? And it was a firefighter or a doctor or a police officer or a cowboy or an Indian or whatever it was that you thought you were going to be. Maybe it was a motorcycle race car driver. Or there was something that most kids at young ages say, yeah, that's what I want to do when I grow up. And however great those dreams were, when you truly tap into what God has for you, you find that there's going to be something beyond that. Might not be as impressive as a NASCAR race driver in terms of what the world sees, but there's something in your heart that will be fulfilled when you step into that. There's something inside you that will feel like, I'm complete, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing right now, and you're the only one that's going to know when that's happening. People can fake it pretty good. I faked it for a lot of years. It wasn't until about 5 years ago that I truly embraced my terror of speaking publicly and pushed past that with the help of Pastor Vaughn, who just wouldn't relent. Endured some pretty dry, I read through some things I had written down because I just knew I was going to be petrified as soon as I got up in front of people. And it was like that for a season. And I thank God that He's taken me through that place because there's a message that needs to be something we all embrace. There's a message of hope and a message of life. And whether you stand up in front of a podium with a microphone and tell it, or you share it with your neighbor or your spouse or your children as you're training them up in the way that they should go, regardless, the message is the same. The message is that in this life without an eternal hope, there's really nothing other than just a sense of, oh, when I get to the next step, I'm going to be fulfilled. There's a ladder to climb. It's corporate ladder. There's these things that are supposed to stepwise take us into fulfillment. And then people get usually into their late 30s, 40s someplace, and you begin to realize that, wait, everything that I thought this was going to be, every step that starts to be put in front of me, when I get it, it's like a week or more, and then it's gone, and I'm looking for the next thing. And this is the nature of the human existence. This is the nature of what it is. There's a desire in us for the next thing. And when it's only able to be sought out in the natural materials of this planet, you're always going to find a place of feeling like that deep place in me is still not fulfilled. It's still saturating itself with other things, whether it's just the numbing power of some people will sit and watch TV for hours upon hours every day, and I just don't understand that. It proves to me that if you can do that, then clearly you haven't found what God's placed inside of you. That's your purpose. That's your destiny. These few years that we have on this planet are so brief and so short, and they're over before you know it. And if you're not maximizing every single moment in it, it tells me that you just don't understand what you're supposed to do. You don't understand what you're supposed to do. You've been equipped and you've been given a hunger and a desire to do something, but you're trying to fulfill that something with the natural things that you can lay your hands on, that you can put in your mouth, that you can ingest or drink or find some way from the natural realm to try to appeal and appease that deep longing in the human existence. And I thank God that there is a place for that to be fulfilled, and it doesn't come by natural things. How many thought that you were going to find the completion of what you were missing when you got married? Careful if you're sitting next to your spouse. Who really thought? Now, a spouse is an amazing thing. I couldn't do anything that I do without my spouse. My spouse is the better part of me. Remember in the garden, when man looked at, and God looked at the whole creation, and He looked at man, everything He said was good. All of it. Read Genesis. He said it was good. And then a little bit later, a few verses later, when He saw the loneliness of man, He said, it's not good for him to be alone. And so the loneliness in the human heart, man being created first, the loneliness that was found there, Eve was God's answer. Woman was God's answer for that. And so before you think that your spouse, if you're a guy and you think that your wife is your problem, be careful, because she was God's idea for the loneliness that you would experience if He hadn't done that for you. Be very careful. You don't want to be the one that's knocking God's answer and God's solution. Of course, we aren't all perfect, and we have to learn how to... I see some wives chatting with their husbands. That's always okay. Maybe I should just take 10 seconds and let you guys hash it out for a minute. And then we'll take another offering. We'll collect the wedding bands, and we'll sell them. But God doesn't always respond to our needs the way that we think He should. He doesn't always give us the... Remember, as soon as sin came into the heart of Adam and Eve, what the first thing Adam did was he blamed Eve. Oh, it was the problem was actually rooted in you, God. You gave her to me. It's just reflex. It's human reflex. When reality, the desire that's in us for something more, the thing that makes it not okay for us to be alone, has to be satisfied. But it can't just be satisfied with natural things. I believe that in the heart of Adam was a hunger and a desire for God. It said that God would come daily and walk with him in the garden in the cool of the day, Adam and Eve together. And when you realize that he came and did that, there had to be something in man that desired that. Otherwise, it would have become... redundant, or didn't we do this yesterday? But I believe there's a depth in God, and he was gradually infusing that into Adam as he would walk daily with him before sin came, before there was that separation. And I realized that there's something in us that's always going to desire the next thing. Don't be alarmed. Your desire for something more in life is not the issue. That's a God-given instinct. It's something that's been placed there because God is that type of God. He's a creative being, and when he creates, the things that he makes carry the same markings and the same characters of who he is. We're made in his image. And I thank God that there is that hunger. We just have to make sure that we're filling it. As our brother Lou encouraged us this morning, you have to be willing to be in the Word. If you're not in the Holy Scripture, if you're not feeding yourself with spiritual food, then you are going to automatically be susceptible to try and fill that void with whatever else you can find. And it's easier to just grab something natural. It's easier to grab an emotionally charged TV series and allow that to be your emotional fix for weeks and months. And some people will find ways for that addiction to grow to where every need they have in their emotional being is, it's not really satisfied, it's virtual, but it takes the edge off it and at the expense of their human natural relationships. But anyways, they find an appeasement in watching someone else's life be fulfilled on a screen in front of them, and they miss the rawness of what we're supposed to feel on a day-to-day basis. When you meet someone new for the first time and you get their phone number in your contacts, there should be a sense of a human being has just... I know a different human being. The things that were made in God's image, there's one more that I know now. There should be this sense of, I feel it. When I get new people that I can text and reach out to, there's something about that there's a smile inside me. Because there's true resource there. A human being is someone who's going to live forever. There's an eternal reality that we were created for that's not just what we go home to and that's not the address on our mailbox. There's a different habitation. Jesus said, I go to prepare a place for you when he was leaving his disciples. What does that mean other than that there's another place besides here that God has a heart to put us into? And it's not a temporary place. It's an eternal place. And when you begin to allow your life to crave that place and you set your affection on what's going to happen at the end of our days, then the things that we use to take the edge off of what's meant to be a desire for God, become childish. I watch some of like the most popular. I just check them out to see like what's the power here, what's the draw here, and there's such a suction on some of the way they're marketed, the way they put all the promotionals out. You're trying to watch a show that you really want to watch, like Duck Dynasty or something meaningful and good, and then you end up sucked into. Is this? Hopefully, Chris forgot to record this. You're not supposed to be too promotional from the pulpit with things like that. But and then you see the promotions for other things, and it's hard not to pick up the start time and when it's going to premiere and not just check it out. And I'll check some of those things out, and then I can see the allure. I can see the draw. But at the end of that hour, you haven't added anything to your life. You literally sit there. You've experienced maybe a week, or it depends on how the time speed, and it's not literal time or we'd be bored out of our minds. So they take sections, and depending on how much they're spreading out real time in those shows, you get to live through someone's whole week or someone's month of life or sometimes an entire lifespan in a documentary. You watch the whole thing in an hour, and it satisfies something in you that was meant to be spent on your next door neighbor. It was meant to be spent on someone who just came to church this morning for the first time. Someone who just came into your life. A new child that was birthed into your life. that you were supposed to be reading to or coloring with or taking out on the swing set or going for a drive to get ice cream, the things that we used to do, you can now not do and just tune in to other people doing them and get a sense that you've just done it, but you haven't. This reality that we live in is so dangerous because it's virtual. And you can feel like you've accomplished something, and really it's all been just inside and inside. And we wonder why, as a human race, we are so, in an unprecedented way, needing to do prescriptions for something as simple as sleep. Sleep. Think about it for a minute. I'm not picking on anybody. I don't know the details of many of your lives, but just think about this. And don't get condemned about it, but think about it. Sleep. The thing that we used to have to fight to keep our eyes open so that we could get enough done in a day, so that we could get enough put away for the harsh winter or for the drought of summer, the things that as humanity, as a human being on planet Earth, that used to, you have to fight the sleep so that you could stay awake long enough, hence coffee and other things that we've come up with, so that we could just fight the sleep back long enough to get done everything we had to do in a day. And now there's so many crutches, there's social crutches, there's all kinds of things. If you can't take care of you, someone else will. And it seems good on the outside. It seems good, oh, well, that's what we should do. We should help people, and we absolutely should. Jesus taught very clearly, if you see someone hungry and you don't feed them, then you're missing me. If you see someone in prison and you don't visit them, you're missing me. It's very clear that he expects us to reach out practically, but the it's not something that can ever replace the spiritual need that's in the heart of people. The need that is there is deeper than what we can just meet in a natural sense. And we have to get beyond thinking that there's a virtual way to experience life. Of course you can't sleep. You haven't hit the wall. Have you ever had a hard time sleeping? After how many marathons did you get to do? Was it 34? 34. 34 marathons. When he got up and talked about the wall during worship, he's talking from experience. This man was miraculously healed by God of life. He was at the end, really, of himself. And God supernaturally touched his body, healed him of chronic ulcers, touched him in a way that he said, I just need to show off what God's done in me. Became a marathon runner. In the course of 12 years, ran 34 marathons. So he knows what he's talking about when he's hitting the wall. Did you ever have a hard time sleeping when you've gone 26.2 miles and you finally get electrolytes back in your body and you don't go home and need to pop something to fall asleep? Maybe some pain medication, I don't know. Something to deal with the blisters and everything else. But I wonder, the body's amazing at what it can produce if you put it through what it's meant to go through before it's time to put your head on the pillow. But because so much of our experience is not literal, it's not meeting someone literally with a handshake and exchanging of information. It's not literal praying for them to be touched and blessed by God. It's not literally going and helping them cut their grass or earning or working a second job to literally give them some extra finance when they're disabled or in a true condition of need. This is what the church was supposed to be. We find that the Apostle Paul, when he would visit churches that didn't have resources, that rather than take from them, he would build sails because he knew how to do it. He would work on boats, even though he's this amazing apostle, preacher of the gospel, he was a tent maker, and so he would work on sails and tents and things with canvas to contribute to the need of the people. There's a practical reality that the things that have, the anxiety that has gripped our culture right now, most of it is because our experiences of life are virtual because they're safer. You're not going to get shot on your couch. You can watch the star of the show get shot and you can cry, but there wasn't a bullet that flew across your living room. You're perfectly safe. You understand? You can feel the sensation of living a dangerous life with your feet reclined, with a drink in your hand, and you can get the sensation of it. We go on roller coasters. We love them. We love the thrills of the stuff that we used to have to do with the top down and on old back roads with a real car, hoping to keep it between the lines. You know, you used to have to jump and do things and fishtail and spin out. I'm like, young guys, don't do any of that stuff. But there's something in humans that's designed to survive the things of this life if you'll embrace them and push through them. And if we don't, we settle for what's safe and what's easy. A three-point harness and a thing, and people think roller coasters are dangerous because every once in a while one goes off the thing, and so it's dangerous to ride roller. It's just virtual. It's perfectly safe. But that's the extent sometimes in church. We come in, And my heart is aching for this community, but they're not going to be drawn into just another level of social network. They're not going to be drawn in because we just smile more than the other churches, or our worship is a little more their style, or our life groups are just a little more relaxed, and they're fun, and there's fellowship, and there's food. All those things have a certain level of drawing power. But the power that God needs to use to be able to break off of people's lives depression and addiction and sleeplessness and all the other things that we have that are coming against us, it's going to take God to do it. It's going to take a spiritual power to truly do it, to truly bring a peace to the inside of us that's going to stand, and it's going to be something that when someone comes in all freaked out, that we're not like, oh, now I'm freaked out too. I didn't know that was about to happen. But we can say, okay, maybe that is going to happen. But you don't have to be afraid about that. See, Jesus was brilliant at being mindful of things and not fearful. And I want to read a story before I just yap on and we end up not going to the Word this morning. It's in Luke chapter 7. I get excited about this stuff because I know that there's people that just need real. We've seen enough. I watch TBN sometimes. I love some of the big names. I love the way they can just seem to preach. And the passion and the response that the people give. I love that stuff. It's not anything wrong with it. There's certain cultures that's where they're going to find their connection to God. And it's not about chopping someone else down so that we can feel better about ourselves. But there is something about real. There's something about genuine. That's why the Jewish people missed Jesus when he came. Because they had read the prophecies and it sounded so a storybook, a white horse and the man on it with fire and a flaming sword. And he was going to evict the Romans and set up the kingdom of peace. And when he came in a manger and he came as he came 30 years old and hadn't really done anything. He just argued in the temple a lot. And he was known, but he hadn't actually done anything. And then in 3 years, he turned the entire community on its head to where the religious leaders felt like they had to just kill him and get him out of the picture. He was creating so much turmoil. He would go into the temple and fashion whip. He fashioned a whip. It means he took some ropes and he didn't just take one. It said he fashioned it. It means he built something and he went in and he drove out the people that were there changing money and selling sacrificial animals. Because it wasn't what the temple of God was ever meant for. And this world has seen enough of what's not real. They've seen enough of the business side of church. They've seen enough of what's marketed as good church marketing. And it has a certain appeal and it gets enough support to fly. But what I believe community, especially in this part of the country, it has to be real. It's got to be people being in the process of fulfilling what's in you. Not every single one of you is going to stand in a pulpit and speak like I'm speaking right now. It's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to talk to the person in the cubicle next to you. When the operator answers the phone and you can tell that she's just flustered, you have the authority. Do you understand? And you call the insurance person, you have the authority to say, "You okay today? I'm just in a really good spot right now, and sounds like you're flustered. I hope that I'm not just one more burden on your list." Try it sometime. Be creative in the way that you approach people. They're the only thing that really has value in this planet. When you do that, you're going to find, oh my goodness, people just are looking. They needed someone to say something nice. You're the only person out of a million callers that will ever say something nice to someone out of your own initiative. Most of the time when we call people, it's about what are we going to get from them? What are they going to do to my race? We're calling to vent on them. We're calling to complain about this and to complain about that. How would you like to be the person on the other end of that that's got to sit there hour in and hour out and hour in? You be a bright voice. You be someone that encourages them. You watch. Not everybody responds. Some of them are just all business. But you start to feel like, okay, there's a light in me. There's a purpose that I'm fulfilling. There's something in me that I need to be able to spend on people in the way that Jesus spent himself. So in Luke chapter 7, verse 37, we're going to read a little bit, all right? It's a story. It's a narrative. Luke 7, verse 36. If you want to turn there. Because Jesus was mindful, but he was not fearful. And I'm not saying we need to be clueless. We shouldn't just walk around with our guard down and allow people to trample us. There's a certain level of wisdom that we have to function in so that we're not just a doormat for everybody. But there is a light and a power and a courage on the inside of a believer that allows us to speak life and light and hope when no one can see it yet. That's our mission. That's our mandate. Why would Jesus call us light if he didn't know he was going to put us into a dark place? Light wouldn't be needed. Did you ever shine a flashlight at the sun or go out in the parking lot? I don't care how powerful the flashlight is. It means nothing. You don't even see it. You can't even see the shadow. No, has no effect. It's doing the same thing that it does at night, except you can't tell. You shine it at night, all of a sudden, the whole parking lot's lit up. You know those big, huge ones that take a car battery? They're amazing. 10 million candle power, spotlights. They're awesome. You take one out right now, you won't even see its effect. Jesus intentionally put us in this atmosphere, in this planet. God has us here because he knows there's going to be darkness. Yes. Let's not be shocked by it and surprised by it. There's supposed to be people that do obscene and disgusting things.
Yes.
That's darkness. There's the present evil age that we're in right now that it's going to happen. If we get shocked and our theology is rocked every time, you don't have a true theology because the Bible's very clear. He gave us to this world to be lights in a dark place.
Amen.
That those who were going to respond to the light would, and those that were going to be offended by it would distance themselves. So we have both things happening. But Jesus was a person who was accessible because he was mindful, not fearful.
Yeah.
And so in Luke 7, there's a really interesting story that we're just going to focus on this morning. Verse 36 says this, "Then one of the Pharisees asked him, Jesus, to eat with him. And he went to the Pharisee's house and sat down to eat." Already it sounds like a trap. Because Jesus was always doing battle with the religious people. He always had something at odds with the people who claimed to know God, who had set up a system that kept people from God, but allowed them to be the people that were between them and God. It was a place of power. It was a place of prestige. It was a place of self-righteousness and self-judgment that the Pharisee rulers had set themselves up as. And so he gets invited by one of these guys, and so he sits down to eat. Now, then, in Middle Eastern culture, the table would be about a foot off the ground, just a very low table, lower than a coffee table. Big table off the ground. They'd put pillows and blankets and stuff on the floor, and you'd recline at the table. And the most common way to recline would be something like, let me see how I can do this, would be like this. The table would be, you'd have the table, you'd have a chair, kind of a cushion propping you up, and you'd be reclining at the table. Your feet would be behind you. You can't kneel at a table for a long term, and you can't sit because it's not the kind of table you would sit your feet under. And so when it says that he's reclining at the table, this is what it says. He sat down to eat. "And behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil and stood at his feet behind him weeping. And she began to wash his feet with her tears, and she wiped them with the hair of her head, and she kissed his feet and anointed them with the fragrant oil." So just a quick visual. She walks in, and she, when we read this, as we read through this, you're going to find that it just, we can read the whole thing in probably 2 minutes. But this didn't happen in 2 minutes. It says she walked in and she stood behind Jesus. Well, how long did she stand there weeping? Because now we find out that she's kissing his feet and using her hair to wash his feet. So there was a whole process that happened. She walked in and she stood behind him crying, the tears falling on his feet. Now that's a very intimidating position, especially in that culture. For a man to be reclined at the table and a woman to even enter in like that and come up from behind and then stand over him and begin to cry. And it's recognized that she was a woman who was known as a sinner. She had issues in her life that everybody there was able to notice that this isn't someone that a Pharisee is going to invite into his house. And yet she heard somehow Jesus is at this guy's house. And suddenly she felt like she was going to be able to get access to him. She couldn't go to the temple if he was there. She wouldn't have been able to go to the other places because they would have blocked her. They would have never let her get in that close to him. And so he's reclining. He's in a vulnerable position. And we find that she's able to approach. And she gets to him, and what can she do but weep? She doesn't even have anything to say. There's no record that she announced her coming in. She just was touched and moved by Jesus' presence and began to weep. The tears were so abundant that they began to fall on his feet. And then they're walking barefoot, right, on dusty dirt roads. So the feet, I have little kids, and so I know they come in, they look clean, and you put them in the shower, and you hit them with the first burst of water, and it runs down their legs, and all of a sudden, like, the floor of the tub is just like chocolate milk. You know what I mean? When they've been out in the sandbox, and it's just, they look clean, and all of a sudden, it gets, water hits it, and it just, you realize how dirty they actually were. And so she sees her tears hitting his feet. They're hitting his feet, and she, in the moment, I don't think she had there's no reason to believe that she had this all rehearsed.
Right, right, right.
We assume things because we can read it so fast, because we're used to just having it play out on a screen in our minds. We don't allow time for it to be real time. This is a real time video account of what's going on. So allow it to happen in your mind in real time. She, She knew he was a sinner, and she brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil and stood behind him weeping. And she began to wash his feet with her tears, and she wiped them with the hair of her head. She kissed his feet and anointed them with the fragrant oil. Now process that for a minute, because this woman was not someone of good reputation and character. This wasn't a mother of one of the Pharisees who just had this vision and she realized, okay, I need to get to Jesus. This was someone of questionable character. Everyone in that room is just got to be feeling like, we're here to have dinner. Remember, the Pharisee had the idea to invite Jesus to dinner. He's in someone else's house. Someone else calls the shots in this place, and she comes in, and this begins to happen. You ever have one of your friends show up at something, and you didn't know they were going to come, and you're at another friend's house that you really kind of care about, but this other kind of friend shows up, and they're a little bit, you know, crazy. Don said it, not me. They're a little crazy. And you don't know whether you should try to just, like, smother them so they don't get to anybody else and let everybody else know that they know you and they know everybody. You do have those. I thought I was the only one. I thought me and Don were the only ones that had those. So she's clearly, her connection to this table is Jesus. She doesn't go to any of the other ones. She goes straight behind him, begins to cry behind him. And the next thing, she's on the floor close enough that her hair is being used to wash his feet with her own tears. You can imagine if this happened, if I'm up here and this happened, and don't get, not that there's anybody here that would get that crazy, but some churches, there's some crazy people. I've been in some of them. First of all, if my wife was here, you wouldn't get past my wife. She's Puerto Rican. You're never going to get past her and start crying. It's just not going to happen. I'll warn you now. In case there's somebody out on the recording someplace that on the internet's going to get some crazy idea, I'm going to look this place up and go and mess with this guy. You won't get past the front row. The ushers might miss you, but my wife will not. And if I allowed it, and if I stood there, And this took a long time. This wasn't, she had this oil, though back then you had to break the jar sometimes to get the stuff out. There was all kinds of process that was going on. And Jesus is sitting there. Remember, she's behind him washing his feet. He's looking around the table. They're sitting facing each other. I wonder what the look was in their eyes. Because he wasn't stopping her. She was there for him. He was responsible to take care of this crazy lady who just somehow got past the people at the door. And is now here at this table. They're trying to enjoy whatever it was that they were eating. And here she is. And he didn't do anything about it. Remember, he's facing them. I can see him looking around the table. Looking at the disdain in their eyes. Can you imagine the... Let's read on. It says, now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he spoke to himself, saying, and it puts quotes, so I believe he muttered this probably to someone sitting next to him. Under his breath, he says, this man, if he were a prophet, he'd know who and what manner of woman this is. He would know who's touching him because she's a sinner. Immediately, Jesus comes and allows something that most people would say is an absolute disgrace. And Jesus is not bothered by it. He sees something in her heart. There's a desperation. She can't go to the temple. She can't go to someone who's not a sinner. There's no one that can help her. Jesus is the only place that she can find help. And they have no concept of the loneliness and the pain that's going on in her heart. They have no reference point for it because they've just been born and raised into good families. They're in this Pharisee's position, which was esteemed in the religious community. They were the ones that people came to for answers. They had a big question in their minds, and they were just in shock, I believe. And so Jesus takes this right to the heart. And he answered to them, to Simon, who turns out to be the guy that invited him. Simon, I have something to say to you. She's here washing his feet. The smell of perfume, the amount to wash a foot in perfume, that kind of fragrance, the whole room. They probably weren't even hungry anymore. That smell had permeated the whole place. Nobody could deny what was happening. It filled the entire room. The smell of the event had captured everyone. You couldn't ignore it anymore. And in that atmosphere, Jesus looks and he says, Simon, I have something to say to you. And so Simon says, teacher, say it. You just got done saying that he didn't believe that he was a prophet or a teacher because he just said if he was, he would have known who this woman. But something about when Jesus spoke, he said, out of honor, he said, teacher, say it. And he said, there was a certain creditor who had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. And when they had nothing with which to repay, he freely forgave both of them. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him more? Simon answered and said, I suppose the one whom he forgave more. And Jesus said to him, you have rightly judged. It's the only thing Simon had judged right that day. He turned to Simon. Sorry, I'm reading it backwards. You have rightly judged. You ready for the right reading? Okay, here we go. Then Jesus turned to the woman, but he said to Simon. You ever have that happen? You're talking to somebody else, but you're looking at somebody. The person you're saying it to, you're looking at somebody else. It's not the person that you're talking to. You're talking to someone that's sitting over there. He gazes into this woman's eyes. Apparently, she's either stood or he's turned around to face her. But whatever it is, he's able to look at her now. And he's looking at her, but he's speaking to Simon. No wonder I got confused. So they turned to the woman, but he said to Simon, do you see this woman? I entered your house and you gave me no water for my feet. She has washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. You gave me no kiss, but this woman has not ceased to kiss my feet since the time I came in. You did not anoint my head with oil, but this woman has anointed my feet with fragrant oil. Therefore I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven. For she loved much, but to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little. This morning I want to ask you as we close, are you willing to discover the price that was paid for your forgiveness? Are you willing to truly discover it? Because we live in a culture that believes, for the most part, as long as I didn't kill someone, as long as I didn't rob somebody's house, as long as I didn't hold someone up at a bank and take the money, I'm basically a good person. I'm basically good. What's God going to hold against me? And we miss what the scriptures reveal about the heart of man that says that it is deceitful and full of wickedness and no one can know it save the Spirit of God. We miss the fact that we were born in iniquity and sin. We miss the fact that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, as Isaiah says. We judge ourselves based on our own perceptions of ourselves. That's what the Pharisees did. What a rude awakening that had to be for him to look at her and then to talk to Simon and say, Simon, you small love. That's what he said. He said, your love is small. Your love is small. You don't understand love. You only understand the law. You understand that if this happens, you do this. If this person's sin happens, then you kill two doves. If this sin happens, you kill a lamb. They understood the old workings of the law, but Jesus was coming to establish a new temple. To establish a new way of connecting with God that wasn't the same as it had been. It wasn't just business as usual anymore. Are you willing to discover the price? Because here's how I'm going to tell you the price in a minute. And I'm preaching the same message in the past 6 weeks probably. I don't even know how long it's been. It's all the same. There's different words that I'm using, but it's the same message. That if you will see the price that's been paid for your life, that if you will accept that what Jesus did was not just some metaphorical gesture. The cross was not a metaphor for the pain and suffering of this life. It was the literal payment for all of sin, past, present, and future. Literal. That is what the cross was. It was not a metaphor. It wasn't just a story. It wasn't something to give us hope in our own valley of despair. It was the essence of the God-man poured out on the earth. And Jesus, knowing that he wasn't limited by time, knew that this woman's sins were more than met at that event that he was on course to fulfill. And the amount of sin is not the point. The point is that every single person was born from a corrupted seed. When Adam sinned in the garden, whether it was Eve's fault or the snake's fault or Adam's fault, it didn't matter. Sin came, and that's the seed that was passed to you through Noah and his family and every other way down the line. No matter how good you are, you were born in sin. You ready for the price? Because not everybody can handle the price. Not because it costs you anything. It doesn't cost you anything. You just have to believe. How many... You can't raise your hand, but I feel like you think you can earn your salvation. You see, if you can be good enough to not deserve to be separated from God, if you can be good enough to be in His presence, you can also be bad enough to exclude yourself from His presence. You gotta let go of the whole, it's not on you. Amen. The faith to believe is on you. Scripture in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 25. We like to use to talk about husbands and wives and how they should relate to one another. We'll just read verse 25 so that we don't have to pass a bag and collect wedding bands. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church, which is us, and gave Himself for her. The price, the value of you is Jesus Christ's life, Himself. Can you imagine that? Jesus Christ became sin. The one that knew no sin became sin for us, so that we might become the righteousness of God in Christ Jesus. You know, love is an interesting... We looked at love last week a little bit. Talked about how you don't have a state of being loveful like you do peaceful or joyful, because love is a little different. Love is a state that exists between two individuals, two entities. Love cannot exist in an individual. It says, for God so loved the world, He had in His heart a relationship, a passion to bring a lost human race back to Himself. Love involves relationship. Love requires that there's some other piece of the equation. It can't just be you. Love, by definition, is a relationship. It is not a state of being. When you're in love, you're not just in love. You're in love with someone. I fell in love with my wife. You fell in love when you held your baby for the first time. You fell in love with that precious life. Love is a state of existence that has to have a counterpart. When Jesus gave Himself, the only way He could describe it in language that we could understand was in the way that a husband would give his life for his wife. Do you understand how the devil had to corrupt marriage in our culture? He had to corrupt love. He had to make it something that was associated with pain so that we would lay it down as the answer for everything that we face. Love casts out fear. Perfect love casts out fear. Nothing else. But because love has such pain attached to it, when I say love, almost immediately people go to a broken relationship where there was vows made to a child that they love, but the child is not following God, and so there's pain. There's pain in love. And so when I say love is the answer, when I say God loves you, you feel a sense of pain rather than the release from the fear. How tragic are we? What place are we in? If the very answer to the fear that rules with an iron fist this culture, if the answer to it is love, and yet we're afraid of the very love that's the anti-venom for it because it hurts. Love hurts sometimes. You ever have a bad conversation with someone and you just promise yourself, I'm never talking to that person again? Why? Because communication is the way that we begin to establish relationship. Love begins to grow when you communicate. The more you talk to someone, you either fall more into love with them or you come more into a place of being reserved about them. It breaks my heart that people don't spend daily time worshiping and praising and talking to God. Communication with God is a heart issue. It's not something you work on. It's something that you do because He's done everything for you. And when you love Him, He loves you. There's the love, the perfect love that casts out your fear. That when you put your head on the pillow at night, your eyes go shut and you're just in His peace and in His rest. He gives you strength to break through the wall, to press through, to go the extra mile, to make it to 26.2 and still have a sense of victory in your heart. I'm going to read this quick. We're wrapping up. Matthew 24, don't turn there. Verse 7 through 13 says this about the last days. This is Jesus telling them, "For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. All these things are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you." He's talking to His disciples. "And you'll be hated by all nations for My name's sake. And then many will be offended. They'll betray one another and they'll hate one another. Many false prophets will rise up and will deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved." Brother Lou prophesied that during worship. Realize what the last tragic, when you're listing events like this, you're going from, he's following a pattern. He's ending with the greatest detriment, the most tragic, powerful statement that he makes is this at the end. "The love of many will grow cold." Folks, if there's no love, fear dominates you. If God's love is not living and active in your heart, if you haven't fallen in love with Christ so that you can be in Christ and be a new creation, you are automatically going to be dominated by fear. You don't have to sign up for it. You will inherit it because that's the age we live in. Everything that happens unexpectedly triggers that fear reflex, that I tried love and it hurt. You got no choice. If you don't spend yourself on someone the way Jesus spent Himself on you, you will never experience true love. You will live, you could maybe live to 80 or 90 or 100 years old and never fill that void that's been created in you that you were supposed to find out and fill it because of fear. Because of fear. The greatest fear you can have is a fear of love because the love casts it out, but people are afraid of that. Because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. I'm asking you this morning, let's just stand together.